Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Anna Farrow is a writer who lives in Montreal. She's been director of the English-speaking Catholic Council in Quebec and writes for the Catholic Register and the Catholic Herald. In 2021, a dreadful accusation was levelled both at the Canadian government, but more particularly at the Catholic Church, who together had run residential schools for Indigenous children in Canada, that a mass grave had been found in the grounds of what had previously been such a school in Kamloops. It was assumed that these were victims of the unspeakable Catholics who'd helped run the schools, and a deep fury gripped the whole of Canadian society, unleashing a wave of hate against the Catholic Church. Anna Farrow wrote an article describing the events for the Catholic Herald, and I'm going to quote from it to set the first part of the scene. On May the 27th, 2021, Chief Rosanne Casimir of the Tkmemloops Tsekwempek First Nation announced that ground-penetrating radar, GPR, technology had located the remains of 215 children on the grounds of the former Kamloops Indian Residential School, located in British Columbia, Canada. The news was readily accepted and publicly grieved by every society figurehead and institution in Canada. On May the 28th that year, the New York Times ran with the headline, "Horrible History, Mass Grave of Indigenous Children Reported in Canada." 3 days following the press conference, a Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, issued an apology for those whose lives were taken at Kamloops. He ordered Canadian flags to be flown at half-mast, and they would remain lowered for nearly 6 months, raised only a few days before November the 11th, Remembrance Sunday. Pope Francis spoke of the shocking discovery of the remains of 215 children in his June the 6th Angelus Address. Taking their lead from the Pope, church communities quickly reacted, and in the following weeks, many congregations set out 215 pairs of child-sized shoes on their front steps. Between the half-mast flags and the little shoes, Canada was covered that summer by a pall of grief that extended from sea to sea to sea. The grief quickly turned to anger. A wave of church buildings and vandalisms ensued. The violence continues to this day, this week, in fact. According to the media outlet True North, some 96 Catholic churches have been burned, damaged, or desecrated in the last 2.5 years. As recently as December, 2 Alberta churches were burned to the ground. Trudeau noted that though burning churches was wrong, the anger was real and fully understandable, given the shameful history that we're all becoming more and more aware of. But the facts are different. GPR findings cited in Kamloops were largely misunderstood by both the media and the public, for they do not provide X-ray images of anything, and certainly not coffins or bodies. They merely show ground disturbances. It would later be revealed that the orchard surveyed at Kamloops was the site of a septic field laid in 1924. To date, no excavations have taken place in Kamloops, despite the federal government allocating $7.9 million for the task in August 2021. No mass bodies have been found anywhere. So why did the international media, politicians, and indeed Canadian Catholics fall so hard for a story that is now being likened to the satanic panic of the 1980s and 1990s. Anna Farrow joins me now to discuss exactly that. Anna Sparrow, it's a great pleasure to meet you and be connected with Montreal. And we're talking because you've written an article recently for the Catholic Herald about one of the latest crises, there have been many, to affect Catholics in Canada. And it's particularly bizarre because it's a crisis that in real life never happened. Could you just introduce us into this latest scandal and talk us through what was claimed to have happened, what hasn't happened, and what the implications of it not happening might be?
Right. You used the word crisis, and one of the writers and journalists who has really sort of opened this up, Terry Glavin, wrote a book actually 20 years ago about one of the residential schools. And in his comments most recently, he says that we have this, Canadians seem to have this bizarre amnesia in which we suddenly discover something. And it seems to happen every sort of 10 to 20 years, as if this is new knowledge or a new discovery. And in fact, these things have been in plain sight. But it's been spun. And so the residential school system, as just a little bit of background for your listeners, was a program that was, administered actually by the various church organizations. And that's not just Catholic. There were Anglican schools, there were United schools, and funded by the federal government of Canada. And so it went basically from the 1870s. The last school closed in 1996. In total, there were about 130 schools in that time period. And it is absolutely undisputed that many of them were poorly run. They were poorly maintained. They were poorly funded by the federal government. It was on a per head basis, basically, that they were funded, and that played into it as well. In total, even historians who are very critical of the residential school system, in total, about a third of Indigenous people, children born during that period between 1870s, 1849, 1870s, there's a evolution of the program, and then 1996, about a third attended residential schools. The rest went to day schools, also kind of administered in the same way.
Can I just ask you, I don't want to spoil your flow, but just in order to give people an unfolding sense of what we're talking about, whilst this has been spun, and we'll come to this and develop it in more detail, as a piece of white supremacist colonialism, oppressing the indigenous natives with white man's education. At the time, presumably, this looked like the most generous way to allow the indigenous population entry into Western civilization, wasn't it?
That's correct. And in fact, when they were first beginning, it was actually seen as very progressive. The provision of education, going right back into the 1600s, you had French missionaries, the Jesuits. It was really seen as care for the people. And the other thing that people don't necessarily know, but Canada actually has a very short history comparatively. Conffederation was 1867. And so there are three Indigenous groups in Canada. There are the Inuit, which are largely the northern, and there are the First Nations, and then there are the Métis, and the Métis are a mix, they're Indigenous European mix ancestry. The First Nations in the West, the western part of Canada, are almost all under treaty. There are treaties between the Crown at the time and the First Nations. And in fact, the provision of Western education was actually embedded into those treaties. And it said, if the chief requests, it is an obligation of the Crown to provide Western education for their people. So yes. And I think, when you talk about this, post-colonial, critical of colonialism, the imposition of Western values and hand in hand with that Christian education. And that, I think, particularly played into the events of 2022. That was the narrative. And that was what was being decried, that this oppressive, patriarchal regime came in and destroyed. And that's the use of the language of genocide, which during the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, they used the term cultural genocide. In 2022, with the so-called discovery of mass graves of murdered Indigenous children, which was the way it was pitched.
I just want to tease out the trajectory of popular perception. I remember in the 1970s reading a book called "Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee," which was an expose of American oppression of Indians, and certainly people in the 70s and 80s began to catch up with the fate of the Indigenous Americans, and it slowly grew, but it grew into a crescendo. I didn't know, and maybe some of our listeners don't either, and are as ignorant as I am. I didn't know that Canada had its own Truth and Reconciliation Commission.
So the establishment of the Truth and Reconciliation Committee came out of a 1996 report of the Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, and that led to the TRC. And the TRC was basically in operation between 2008 and 2015. And just to say that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was not set up as an investigation or a documentation. It was simply an exercise in allowing Indigenous people to tell their story. And they were never challenged, and not to say that, but it was just to say that they did not have access to a lot of federal records. And so we tend to think of, okay, well, this was a thorough investigation, and putting all the documentation there, and that's not what it was. It was across Canada, allowing for people to tell their story, which of course is very important. It is important to hear those stories. But yeah, so then there were something like 94 recommendations. One of those was that the Pope come to Canada to issue an apology on Canadian soil. But going back in 2008, the then Prime Minister Stephen Harper issued an apology for the role that the federal government played. Then First Nations Chief Phil Fontaine traveled to Rome with a small delegation, met with Pope Benedict, and Pope Benedict expressed his sorrow at what was happening. So this is almost decades ago that these things took place.
So there were two apologies. One was from the Canadian government, because this was a Canadian government project. It's just so happened that the people who furnished the project was the Catholic Church. This was supposedly an act of charity to implement what the state wanted to do as an act of cultural generosity. And so we have two agents in this: the government whose plan it was, and the Catholic Church who actually delivered it. And presumably they shared mutual responsibility. And my guess is that out of the stories that were told, there was a level of depressingly normal abuse that always takes place in institutions, which doesn't legitimize it for a moment, but puts it in the scale of ordinary human failure. Would that be about right?
Yes, and I mean I don't ever want to downplay, and I think this is the problem with what happened in 2022, and what happened with the subsequent media fallout, because and I'll give a little background to what happened in 2022, but there's been then this backlash, and people have actually in international press, the word hoax has been used as if this was sort of deliberately, the whole thing was deliberately concocted. And what happens in there, and this is the thing, is, Archbishop Miller, and this has been repeated many times, there can be no reconciliation without truth. Reconciliation is required. The Indigenous peoples of Canada have suffered greatly, and that suffering continues to this day. There are I can't pull the number out of my head, but there are something like 30 communities where there are boil water advisories, where people don't have clean running water, where they have cisterns. The problem is that you have this huge outpouring of guilt and collective guilt in 2022. And then as the story is dismantled and unpacked, then there's a reaction among certain parties. Either there's just a blanket ignoring of the fact that these things that were said to have happened didn't happen. So they just ignore it. It's just, oh, well, really, or just counting, oh, well, you know, that's not really the case. But then you have this backlash, and none of that furthers the real reconciliation that is required, you know?
So can I make a distinction between what I was saying? When I was saying there was the normative failure of institutional life, I wasn't intending to downplay the crisis in Aboriginal relationships in America. But I mean, you quite helpfully have added to that. So I mean, I think most people will say any abuse that took place is too much abuse. But then there's a question of you know, where it lies, if you like, on the scale of abuse. But again, my guess is that a lot of people outside Canada won't know about the Indigenous suffering, about the way in which Indigenous communities are left on the outside and under-resourced. They won't know whether that's by choice or whether by malign neglect from the government. I mean, I think it'll be as astonishing for people in Europe to hear that there are citizens of Canada who don't have access to clean running water. That's going to be news to some people. So we have two things here. We have the institutional abuse, which we'll talk about in a moment. We have the government, I presume it's government failure, and then we'll get on to the issue of the graves that weren't in a moment. Can you just say a bit more about the government failure for Indigenous communities so people know what you're talking about?
So basically in those treaties, the Indigenous communities, the First Nation communities, are on land that is theirs. There's then a reciprocal requirement of the federal government to provide certain basic necessities to them, and one of them is water. And there's been move by many First Nation communities to really utilize the resources that they have, but there's just a long history of both provincial and federal government and the federal government abusing that trust. So, yeah, I mean, and that's just an ongoing problem.
And presumably that's part of what energizes the guilt.
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing is, and so let's just, you know, go back to 2022 for those people who don't know. So basically, in the May of 2022, one of the West Coast Aboriginal communities had a press conference, and they said that through the use of this ground penetrating radiology, forget the actual GPR, that 215 bodies, that they had determined that there were 215 bodies of children on this in Kamloops, which is in British Columbia, on the property of what had been a residential school. And this just really, it was a tsunami of reaction to this announcement. And, you know, I was looking back, even into the summer, even among people who had a pretty good knowledge of the situation, we were still using those terms. We were still using, yes, this, you know, this is these bodies, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
It looks like mass murder, doesn't it?
Yeah. And the word used was mass grave. And of course, mass grave has connotations for anybody in the West of war crimes, that there was this, that it was happened at one time and that, you know, these bodies were just dumped and covered up, and that this was a secret. You know, again, we've lived through so much in the last 4 years, but it really was a very difficult time for, particularly for Canadian Catholics, I would say. And I just want to give a little anecdote. Our local parish church, where we attended for decades, and there's a drive to get into the church. And that summer, we arrived for church, and right on the corner where you turn in, there was a young man standing there with a poster or a board, and it just had a number, 715. And nobody was stopping. So my husband actually went out and spoke to him at length. He didn't get into the mass until I think, you know, and was just speaking with him. And he felt that there was a kind of collective guilt for every single Catholic.
What does 715 refer to?
715. So there were a bunch of numbers that were going around. So we had the original over 200, 215 was the number in Kamloops. And then there have been other sites. And so they in that summer, they were kind of adding up, you know, this must have happened here and this must have. And so the number kind of went up. And so there were billboards all around, like people handmade things outside of Catholic churches with this number, little shoes. And I talk about that. That was a thing. And that was done by Catholic congregations. There were a number of churches, even in here in Montreal, a number of Catholic churches that did that themselves. The parishioners went out and those shoes were on the steps right through that summer. And just to go back, so, you know, and the Canada Day celebrations, July the 1st is Canada Day, and it doesn't have quite the same punch as July the 4th in the United States, but it's certainly an important day. And there were celebrations that were canceled right across. So no, you know, right across Canada, we're not going to have, you know, we're not going to have fireworks. There aren't going to be the celebrations. And so there was this sense of just being, there was a pall that was put right over the country during that time.
And by this time, presumably, if my memory is right, the guilt that the federal government might have been assumed to bear disappeared, and almost all the guilt was borne by the Catholic Church or community. Is that right?
And that was such a fascinating thing. That was such a fascinating thing. And when you look back at what Justin Trudeau was saying, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was saying, I think he was quite happy to throw this of the Catholics, despite, you know, and again, talking about this amnesia that took place. So, and then the church burnings. So, you know, and that's the thing. And that continues to this day. Last week, there was an episode in Regina in Saskatchewan, where a Molotov cocktail was ignited outside a Catholic church. And there was a non-denominational historical log church that was burned to the ground. That was last week. So this carries on.
Just for the record, what we haven't yet said is that the number 715 was fictitious and there were no children's bodies found there.
Correct. So to this date, where there have been excavations, no bodies have been found. In the Kamloops situation, despite the fact that the federal government gave millions of, I think, I'm going to pull this number, I think it's about 9 million, specifically to this community, that community have said that they don't find it culturally appropriate to do excavations, that they want to just be able to grieve. But what has transpired, and what people misunderstood at the time about this technology that was used, basically this technology does not, it's not like an X-ray or, you know, an ultrasound where you somehow see something revealed under the ground. All this technology does is show where there are anomalies or where there's, you know, shifting in the ground, that sort of thing. Now, the woman who did this, did the work, later clarified, you know, this is not, it's not showing coffins, it's not showing, you know, bones or anything. And in that particular instance, it was in an apple orchard. There'd been a lot of digging and moving around of the soil because there had been a septic system that had been laid in the 1924. And so you know, for again, septic systems rely on the laying of tile and pipe. In fact, looking kind of juxtaposing the laying of the septic field against what this technician found, the laying of the tiles would have been at exactly the same kind of level as these ground anomalies that she had discovered. Now, there may be bodies there, but we're never going to know as long as there's no excavations. And the other thing to remember is that this is not, none of this is new. There are unmarked graves, and there's been a lot of research and a lot of work done on this. There was a professor in Thunder Bay up in Ontario who worked basically from 2013 to 2015 identifying residential school-related grave sites. This is well documented. And in Canada, and particularly at that time, there was a high mortality rate, largely due to communicable diseases like tuberculosis. So if you think about, you know, the Spanish flu, which had a very high mortality rate, but tuberculosis hit the indigenous communities very hard. And so, yes, children were buried in grave sites close to these residential schools, if not like, you know, because they were mission schools. So you would have had the school, you would have had the church, and you would have the graveyard. And when the federal government was closing up these residential schools, there was no plan in place. And these children, the federal government wasn't paying for if you had a young kid who died of tuberculosis at the school, the federal government wasn't paying for the child to be moved back to the community. The parents certainly didn't have the money for it. The church didn't have the money for it. And so they were buried in grave sites, you know, close to the school or on school grounds. And they weren't the only ones who were being buried there. There would have been the children of missionaries in the case of Anglican or the United Churches. You would have had their children. You would have had teachers. You might have had priests and nuns who were buried there. And very often they were marked by wooden crosses. And those wooden crosses in the Canadian weather system would have disintegrated. And then those residential schools would have been moved out. And you have a grave site that has unmarked graves. But what happened in 2022 is that quickly became that, you know, that whole history was forgotten. And then you just had this rush in to sort of this mental picture that people had of, you know, priests killing children in the middle of the night and, you know, digging a hole somewhere and throwing this murdered child into. And that was kind of in the collective head. That was what was understood, you know, that it was nefarious, it was hidden, and that there were crimes that were committed that were not revealed, you know, until now. And then, oh my goodness.
So now we have as many of the facts as we can get. And there's this huge disparity between what was claimed and what actually happened. As far as we can understand, we have effectively a group psychosis and scapegoating. Both of these have happened at times in history before. Is there any particular reflection or grasping of why this group psychosis and this kind of scapegoating laid on the shoulders of the Catholic Church in particular at this moment in cultural history?
I mean, I've thought a lot about that. I think there is guilt. There is guilt because Indigenous peoples have been, the relationship has been fraught from the get-go. And so there is this sort of collective guilt. But the way the narrative was spun, the language that was used in the media and in academia and just in people's the way people were discussing it, there was a widespread adoption of the colonial oppressor, of the native population, the cruelty of the Catholic Church. There was a sort of a distinction that was drawn between this kind of new woke Canada and the oppressive Catholic Church. And, you know, it's really people struggle against it today. What people forget is that 47% of the Indigenous in Canada are Christian. And the way it was portrayed in the media was that this was a superimposing of a foreign culture on a people that had their own spirituality that could not be questioned or tampered with, you know. And this is a huge problem for people, for Indigenous leaders who are Christian, and that somehow that is questioned by the sort of secular people. They it's almost like, well, you're not really that, you know, that's maybe something that you need to, you know, to let go of and to return to, you know. And they're like, listen, you know, it was my great, you know, interestingly, one a very prominent Catholic Indigenous leader, a First Nation, is a man called Graydon Nicholas. And he was a lieutenant governor of New Brunswick. He was a judge, lieutenant governor of New Brunswick between 2009 and 2014, very devoutly Catholic. And he points out, you know, evangelization began in the Atlantic, on the maritime side, when a priest baptized a Mi'kmaq Grand Chief in 1610. And there's just generation after generation of Indigenous Christians. But the narrative was this was an imposition, that this is not truly who they are, and that that needs to be atoned for. You know, the evangelization and the missionary work needs to be atoned for, rejected, and we need to all move on and let people just be. Well, which is just a ridiculous kind of, you know, twisting of things. Just to give an example of how that played out, there is still an article on the CBC website, the Canada Broadcasting Corporation. It's the equivalent to the BBC. I think the byline was Montreal. So it was about Quebecers. It was noting, I think it was a summer of 2022 article that basically was saying how many people were apostatizing and approaching, you know, the Archdiocese of Montreal to revoke their Catholicism. And the reason cited by people for this article was that it was their way of standing with Indigenous people, as if, right, that there weren't Indigenous people who were deeply traumatized by what was going on in the burning of the churches on these Native reserves, as if this was not their faith, that somehow this was separate from them, that they weren't truly Catholic, that they really at heart, you know, should be embracing Native spirituality. It was mind-blowing, you know, what was going on, and still kind of is in, that's in the collective consciousness, you know, that thought.
Well, I wanted to ask you about Native spirituality, because it seemed to me that there are two things going on here. One, I think we're agreed on, and you've touched on, which is that Native spirituality has become, at least in secular relativistic terms, something supremely sacred, so that as I've listened to Canadian culture and discussions, in terms of the pecking order of or the epistemology of religious experience, the naturalistic eco-friendliness of Native spirituality has developed a kind of sanctity of its own.
Absolutely, absolutely, and is sectioned out as having special privilege, and this is it really played out in Canadian life. And I'll give you a little example. So just before Remembrance Day, the military chaplains made an announcement, or the head of the military chaplains of the Canadian Armed Forces made an announcement that military chaplains were not to pray at Remembrance Day ceremonies, and that there would be no mention of God, that this that for many people, this would be sort of a patriarchal, you know, it would be traumatizing because it would be, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Military chaplains could muse on Canadian values, but there was to be no specific religious language. And a year earlier, And this is still true to this day. I was at a large event hosted by a federal department. There were about 200 people. It was all federally funded. It was a federal department event. And at the opening, there was a Indigenous elder, which she's a professor at the University of Ottawa. She's very well known, who is kind of on the circuit, who did a prayer to the elders. She had her feather, you know, she was doing it. There's a certain protocol for this, overtly religious in that sense. That's okay in the world of federal politics, that you would have this government gathering, government subsidized gathering for, you know, something completely, you know, to do with, it was actually having to do with minority language issues. But you would have that. And, you know, when I lean over to a colleague who's not Catholic and I say, you know what, if we had a Catholic priest up there doing his thing, there would be, I mean, the outcry would be, but people don't see that. So yes, absolutely. It has a special place, despite the fact that among the Indigenous population, the actual practice of the traditional ways is under 10%. I don't know the exact number, but there are a much higher percentage of Indigenous peoples in Canada who identify as Christian than there are who identify with the traditional ways and practice.
So that's very interesting. And thank you very much for pointing it out, because it puts the thing in an entirely different perspective. To 10% committed to Indigenous spirituality, nearly 50% who are actually Christian. And presumably alongside of the fact that Indigenous spirituality, for ecological and fashionable reasons, as well as a certain kind of romanticizing, that stands on one side. My own sense has been, becoming a Catholic, and one of the reasons I became a Catholic, is that Catholicism is, if you like, the agency, the philosophy, the most distinctively powerful agency that stands against woke progressive ideas. So Catholic ethics, Catholic sexuality, the deep-rootedness of Catholic philosophy, there isn't any other alternative agency, not amongst liberal Protestantism, not amongst any other major world religions, perhaps Islam, but we'll put that in brackets for the moment. But there isn't any other belief system that poses quite such a threat to secular wokery or the march of the progressive left. So it seems to me that one of the reasons that might underlie this group psychosis and this scapegoating is the combination of giving extra credit to an Indigenous spirituality that's been mythologized in political practice, and an attempt to be frightened of or to punish the Catholic community, which still retains some level of critical threat to the whole platform upon which progressive culture is being moved. Does that begin to offer an account for both the group psychosis and the scapegoating, or are there other things we've missed?
No, and I mean, I think that, I mean, it was so bizarre, that whole period, and you know, continuing to this day. And it was such a chokehold what the primary mission of the church is, which is evangelization, of the announcing of the good news of Jesus Christ for all people, the power of the cross for renewal and redemption for individual lives, no matter what their cultural background. It was such a chokehold on that. It was a cloaking, and people and the bishops and individual priests and individual lay people, I think, we were all under that cloud, and it led to, you know, that thing that people do under threat, you know, fight, flight, or freeze. And there was a freezing. There was just a sort of cowering in place, as this wave of hatred and animosity, you know, rolled over. And to that point, there was something, and, you know, not to, but there was something truly demonic. Satan is the father of lies. And this was the way this was couched still wanting to recognize there was you know, horrible things that took place, but what happened, it was a lie. And then there was this freezing, and so people felt, I think, constricted in that role of evangelization.
That's very helpful to talk about the freezing like that, because I'm sure you're right. And it explains why it's so incredibly difficult then to find, for spokespeople for Catholicism, for apologists, to find anything to say, because almost anything you say makes it worse, particularly if you're dealing with a sort of a group psychosis or made much worse, perhaps, by metaphysical elements in the way you've described. Has there been any success at all in finding Catholic spokesmen, either a priest or bishops, to speak out and say, look, this is untrue, it's unfair, it's a distortion of history, it's a distortion of the Catholic identity in the community. We've been part of the creation of some of the very best things in terms of human rights and the sanctity of the human person and compassion for the weak. We've been part of the best things in our society. You're not giving us credit for it. You're actually, this is a piece of almost blood libel, certainly social libel. Has there been any opportunity to say that?
I think things are beginning to crack, because you have to remember, it wasn't just, you know, on the pages of the Globe and Mail or, you know, on the CBC. It was happening within Catholic communities, and the bishops have been very reluctant to speak up or speak out. There's one bishop, the emeritus bishop of Calgary, who is very, very ill, and he's always been very, very outspoken. But he, you know, he was calling, saying, you know, the record needs to be set straight here. Interestingly, you know, the occasion for the article was the publication of this collection of essays called Grave Error. And interestingly, you know, a number of the people who have kind of gone to the battle lines on this are of Jewish background. And there's a fellow called former professor Jaime Rubinstein and a Canadian journalist Jonathan Kay, who is the Canadian editor of Quillette. And I suspect that part of it might be that the attempt to shift, that it was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that used the term cultural genocide. And then in 2022, there was this move to speak to a physical genocide. And, you know, I think possibly, you know, for people who have, Jewish background or Jews, that might just stick in the craw a little bit too much. And so I think, you know, in answer to your question, I think the heads are becoming, you know, rising above the parapet a little bit, but it's on the back of other people's work. And is, you know, it's kind of like, is it safe? Is it safe to come out? Is it safe to say? And I think that ground is beginning to be cleared. Having said that, I wrote the article that I wrote for the Catholic Herald. I had written something shorter and more specific, you know, sort of more understandable for Canadians who have a little bit of the background, for the Catholic Register. The Catholic Register got blowback just for publishing basically a review of this book, Grave Error, which is saying all of these people agree on one thing. You know, what was said to have happened in 2022, the discoveries that were, you know, that there's no justification for that. That's, you know, that's the only thing. But got some serious blowback. Probably some I shouldn't, you know, put on the record. But yes, I think in answer to your question, I think things have calmed down a little bit. I think the international press attention to the fact that no bodies have been, you know, yet discovered, despite millions of dollars of funding to discover, that it is perhaps becoming safe. And I think, you know, really the heroic standing up of Indigenous Catholics, just briefly through a couple of different interactions, a woman who is actually, she works in the gas and oil sector. She grew up on a reserve in Saskatchewan. She's of Cree background. And she was raised by her grandparents. Her mother was, her grandmother was a devout Catholic, and her grandfather practiced the traditional ways. And she's a relatively young woman, and she made the decision to follow in her grandfather's footsteps. And she practices traditional native spirituality. But she wrote a letter in the National Post, which is one of the big national newspapers, in 2022, when there was started, the church burnings were starting, just decrying it. And I just actually want to read a little thing that it wasn't in the article, but later her reflections. She talks about her kokum, her grandmother. And she says, if my grandma had seen that happen, she would be really hurt. Her grandmother had passed away. That would really bother her because she was a residential school survivor, but she was also Catholic and she believed in that faith. And if she ever saw anybody burn down a church, that would be traumatic for her to watch. And for them to say that they were doing it on her behalf would be even more traumatizing for her than being in the residential school. We're not taught to harm other people, and that's just not one of our teachings. And if there's animosity out there between the traditional way of life and, let's say, Christianity, we figure out what the issue is and work on it. We want peaceful, respectful relationships with people of other faiths. I never grew up with hatred and animosity towards another's religion or beliefs. To see all that unfold, I was speechless for months because I didn't know how to address it. I just thought that was so interesting. She was saying her kokum would have been more disturbed by that than her experience as a residential school survivor.
I think we can give her the last word. And I think, too, we ought to recognize, as you quite rightly say, that it's quite a moment when we give credit both to Indigenous Catholics, but also to the Jewish community, who know a great deal about being on the receiving end of group psychosis and scapegoating. So Anna Farrow, thank you for helping put the record straight and telling the truth. It's enormously important we should be able to do that, and you've been very clear and helpful in achieving that. Thank you very much for taking the time and trouble and joining me on the Catholic Herald podcast. We're very grateful. Thank you.
Well, it's been a real privilege and pleasure.